Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from coast to coast. And joining me to begin the show, as the revelations are coming out, you know, Scott McClellan's new book is being leaked and all this other stuff. And Vincent Bugliosi has been at the lead of figuring out what's going on in the brains of truly crazy people for a long, long time. This guy has successfully prosecuted 105 of 106 felony jury trials, including 21 murder convictions. He wrote Helter Skelter, the book about Charles Manson. And now, following on that, he has written The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. Vincent Bugliosi, welcome, sir.
Happy to be on the show, Tom. I want to tell you, my wife listens to you every day. She loves your show.
Oh, well, thank you. Please give her my very best regards.
Yep.
You, in your book, you talk about, and I was rostered as a psychotherapist by the state of Vermont, although I'm in Oregon now, so I'm not legal and I can't diagnose people. But, you're describing, it seems, in reading your book, you say, for example, George Bush hasn't suffered at all over the monumental suffering, death, and horror he has caused by plunging this nation into the darkness of the Iraq War, probably never losing a wink of sleep over it. That's part of a fairly straightforward diagnosis for clinical sociopathy.
Yeah, that's
narcissistic personality disorder.
That's not the heart of my book. As you know, this is the most explosive book of my career,
yes.
Putting George Bush on trial for murder in an American courtroom. But what makes it all the worse, in addition to the evidence that I hope we have time to talk about why he's guilty of murder, the evidence is overwhelming, Tom, that throughout the hell on earth that Bush created in Iraq, with over 100,000 people dying horrible, violent deaths and hundreds of thousands of their survivors crying out hysterically and having terrible nightmares over what happened to their loved ones, George Bush, the evidence is very clear, has smiled through it all. In fact, if you see a photo of Bush and six or seven other people smiling, who has the biggest smile on his face? Unbelievably, George Bush.
Yeah, in fact, you have that photo montage in your book.
Yeah,
you know,
the evidence is very clear, Tom, that at the very same time, the young American soldiers who never had a chance to live out their dreams were being blown to pieces by roadside bombs in Iraq. Bush was having fun and enjoying life to the fullest, running, bicycling, joking with friends, slapping backs, dancing and swiveling his hips like Elvis to blaring music, eating hot dogs and blueberry pie, and so often appearing to be in the very best of good spirits.
Yeah.
And if anyone in your audience is questioning what I'm saying, you don't have to take my word for it or pay any attention to the photographs or videotapes. Bush himself has had no hesitancy at all telling us how much he's enjoyed himself throughout the entire period of the war, saying things like this: Laura and I are having the time of our lives. I'm in a great mood. It's a perfect day. I'm feeling pretty good about life. But that's not what my book's about. That's just the prologue to the prosecution. The book's about putting Bush on trial for murder in an American courtroom, and I've come up with incontrovertible evidence that he took this nation to war under false pretenses.
So let's get right to it here in the 5 or 6 minutes that we have. What you are arguing here as a former prosecutor, a guy who has prosecuted murderers,
right.
I think the conversation about the parallels between him and somebody like Charlie Manson, whose life you also chronicled, are fascinating. But just, you know, looking at the crime itself and setting aside the mental state of the guy who did it, as a former prosecutor, this is a prosecutor's brief. Lay out the brief for us.
Okay, well, let me give you one very strong piece of evidence, and I have many, many more other pieces in the book, but I think this is illustrative. Tom, in George Bush's first speech to the nation on Hussein in Iraq, October 7th, 2002, Cincinnati, Ohio, he told the American people that Hussein was a great danger to our nation, either by Hussein attacking us with weapons of mass destruction or by giving these weapons to a terrorist group to do so. And he said that this attack could happen, quote, on any given day, unquote, meaning the threat was imminent.
Right.
The only big problem for George Bush, and at his trial, I don't know how he could get around it, is that on October the 1st, just 6 days earlier, the CIA sent Bush its 2002 National Intelligence Estimate. That's a classified, top-secret report that represented the consensus opinion of all 16 U.S. intelligence agencies on the issue of whether or not Hussein was an imminent threat to the security of this country. And page 8 of that report, Tom, clearly and unequivocally says, and by the way, what I'm about to tell you, to my knowledge, has never appeared in any major newspaper or magazine in America. Why? I can't tell you. When I say I can't tell you, I don't know. But the report clearly and unequivocally says that Hussein was not an imminent threat to the security of this country, that he would only be a threat to us if he feared that America was about to attack him. In other words, Hussein would only be a threat if he was forced to fight in self-defense. So we know then, we're not talking about thinking, we're talking about knowing, that when Bush told the nation on the evening of October 7, 2002, that Hussein was an imminent threat to the security of this country, he was telling millions of unsuspecting Americans the exact opposite of what his own CIA was telling him. Now, as a prosecutor, I can tell you, if we had nothing else at all, and there's so much more in my book, this alone shows that George Bush took this nation to war on a lie, and therefore all the killings of American soldiers in Iraq were unlawful killings and murder. And it gets worse, Tom. On October the 4th, just 3 days after the October 1st, 2002 classified report, Bush and his people had the CIA issue an unclassified summary version of the classified report so they could release this report, this unclassified version, to Congress and the American people. Right. And this unclassified version, Tom, became known as the White Paper. And in this white paper that was shown to Congress and the American people, the conclusion of U.S. intelligence that Iraq was not an imminent threat to the security of this country was completely deleted. Every single one of these all-important words were taken out. And the question I have of you, Tom, it's a rhetorical question, how evil, how perverse, how sick, how criminal can Bush and his people be? Yet unbelievably, and there's no other word for it, up to this point, he has gotten away with all of this. But this book, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder, may change all of this and put these people in an American courtroom. There's going to be a documentary for the big screen based on my book. And as we're speaking right now, the documentarians, under my direction, are reaching out to prosecutors around the country to bring murder charges against Bush. What I've done in my book, I've created the jurisdiction, and I did an enormous amount of legal research here, to have local, state, and federal prosecutors bring charges against Bush, close to 1,000 prosecutors, mostly on a state level. I've created jurisdiction for the attorney general in each of the 50 states, plus district attorneys, hundreds of district attorneys from counties within those states, to prosecute Bush for the murder of any soldier or soldiers from their state or county who died fighting George Bush's war. Now, with all of those prosecutors out there, and with the tremendous amount of evidence of guilt, and I've just given you some of it, set forth in my book, it's not unreasonable to believe, Tom, I'm not saying it's a high likelihood, but it's not unreasonable to believe that at least one prosecutor out there, and maybe many more, will step forward, have the courage to step forward and say, wait a while, this is the United States of America. No man is above the law. The evidence of Bush's guilt is very clear. I'm going to go after this guy and bring about justice for the American people. This very well could happen. I'm very serious about this. At this stage in my career, I don't have time for fanciful reveries. Bush could end up in an American court after he leaves office. As you know, he's got immunity right now. But once he leaves office, he could end up in an American courtroom being prosecuted for murder.
236 days, 12 hours, 36 minutes, 58 seconds. we're talking with Vincent.
Good,
yeah, we're talking with Vincent Bugliosi. His new book, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. And this is extraordinary. Sir, we have to take a break in about 45 seconds. Can you stick around over the break? I've got a couple other questions
I'd like
to follow.
Absolutely.
Great. Before we get to the 30 seconds or so we have left, how long has it been since that national intelligence estimate of 2002 was declassified? How did you, you know, when you found out about it and put it in your book and you say it has not appeared in any newspapers?
It was declassified in 2004, and it's amazing. The LA Times, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Time and Newsweek, they refer to it. They refer to it, but they do not refer to the fact that the conclusion was totally deleted from the October 4th white paper. They do not mention that, and they also don't mention what the conclusion was.
This is like the ultimate smoking gun. I mean, this is what Scotty McClellan is talking about. We were just, well, I'll tell you about this when we come back from the break.
I'd like to talk about the Manning memo, too.
Okay, great. We'll do it. It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's a Tom Hartman radio program on Air America Radio. We're talking with Vincent Bugliosi, his new book, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. 16 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman. Speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman program.
Song from GW, that's me, and the Carlisle Group. Here we go, get real close. Strangers in the night, exchanging gunfire, liberals so uptight, call me a liar, challenging my war, before my term is through.
Oh, how dare that, Scotty McClellan.
Something in their eyes is getting scary. Keeping to my plan is getting hairy. Every day it's hard to do the things I do.
Well, doesn't quite look that way, George, actually, other than singing.
Justify my fight. Please, Limbaugh, Hannity, O'Reilly on the right. Keep my agenda on the burners burning bright. Because I'm so uptight, demonize the left today and take their right to speak away. And
22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. The man who prosecuted Charlie Manson. The man who, three times New York Times best-selling author, Vincent Bugliosi, is with us. His book, The Prosecution, his new book, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. Sir, we were speaking this morning on the telephone with George Monbiot in the UK. He is going to be on our program tomorrow. We were discussing the possibility of arranging a live feed. He is probably at this moment trying to perform a citizen's arrest on John Bolton in Wales. Bolton is there speaking at some public event, and he's trying to perform a citizen's arrest for genocide, basically. And yesterday, I forget which guest it was, we were speaking with somebody, and they were talking about, you know, creating an environment where George Bush can't leave the country, where he basically is facing the Pinochet problem. But you're talking about creating a situation where George Bush can't find a safe state, having him prosecuted across the United States. Your book, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder, you said that there was a second point that you wanted to get into.
Well,
in it.
Yeah, I have much, much evidence in the book, but I want to mention a second point, which all by itself, let's throw out what I told you earlier, assuming it didn't even exist. Let me give you some irrefutable evidence again against George Bush.
That this man is guilty of murder, of prosecutable murder, felony murder.
Yeah, January 31st, 2003, less than 2 months before Bush ordered the invasion of Iraq, Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair met in the Oval Office with six of their top aides, including Bush's National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice, and Blair's Chief Foreign Policy Advisor, David Manning. After the meeting, Manning prepared a five-page memo stamped, quote, extremely sensitive, unquote, summarizing from his notes what was said at the meeting. And he wrote that Bush and Blair expressed their doubt that any weapons of mass destruction would ever be found in Iraq. Now, this is 2 months before Bush goes to war saying that Hussein does have weapons of mass destruction.
Hmm.
But it gets much worse than that. He also wrote that Bush was so worried about the failure of UN inspectors to find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq that, unbelievably, Bush talked about three possible ways, Manning wrote, to, quote, provoke a confrontation, unquote, with Hussein, one of which Bush said was to, quote, fly U-2 aircraft over Iraq falsely painted in United Nations colors. Mm-hmm. And if Hussein fired on them, Bush said, he would be in violation of UN resolutions – and that would justify war. So what we're talking about here now, Tom, Bush is telling the American people that Hussein is an imminent threat to the security of this country, so we had to strike first in self-defense. But behind closed doors, this small man, George Bush, was talking about how to provoke Hussein into a war. I can tell you, Tom, that the last person in the world whom someone acting in self-defense would try to provoke is the person he is in deathly fear of, the person who is about to kill him. If Bush actually felt that Hussein was an imminent threat to the security of this country, which he was telling Americans and telling the world, and it was his main basis for going to war, the thought of provoking Hussein into a war obviously would never, ever have entered his mind.
Yeah.
So we're dealing with a big criminal here. He belongs in an American courtroom, and if the jury convicts him of first-degree murder, it would then be up to them to decide what his punishment should be, one of the options being the imposition of the death penalty. And I have to tell you, I'm very serious about this now. I only write serious books. I don't write reveries or fiction or anything like that. I'm very, very serious about this. We're reaching out to prosecutors throughout the country. This guy cannot be permitted to get by with over 100,000 murders, but up to this point, he's gotten by with it completely. And the amazing thing is I'll give you an example of when people talk about impeachment. There was a book convention out here a couple years ago, and I read. I don't know if I wasn't there. The guy gets up and says Bush should be impeached, and unbelievably, he gets a 2 or 3 minute standing ovation.
Yeah.
That shows how tenuous people's grasp of reality is. Of course, George Bush should be impeached. That's too self-evident to state. But for what he did, he deserves much more than impeachment. I mean, in America, Tom, as you know, we apparently impeach presidents for having consensual sexual relations outside of marriage and trying to cover it up.
Right.
Now, if we impeach presidents for that, then if the president takes the country to war under false pretenses and as a direct result, over 4,000 American soldiers and over 100,000 innocent Iraqis die horrible, violent deaths, obviously the punishment has to be much, much more severe. That's just common sense, isn't
that it? That is murder. Sir, we're out of time. But Vincent Bugliosi, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder, a great book. And thank you, sir, for coming on.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartmann Program. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. Work all week long, punching that clock dust till dawn, counting the days to Friday night. That's when all the conditions are right for a good time. I need a good time.
Yeah, we're having a good time, and we're going to have a real good time tomorrow night in San Francisco. Join me and our friends at Green 960, KKGN, for a night of unity. John Scott, Angie, Barack Obama, and Hillary Clinton delegates, not the candidates themselves, but delegates who are pledged to or are supporting Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. We're all going to get together at the Hotel Sofitel in Redwood City. Tickets are $10. Just show up at the door. No pre-registration necessary. A portion of the proceeds going directly to the California Democratic Party. And we're going to have a conversation about, is it possible to put this party back together, to put this nation back together? I think it's going to be fascinating. By the way, coming up in the rest of our program in the second hour, Terry Jeffrey is going to drop by. He's the editor-in-chief at CNSNews.com, what used to be called the Conservative News Service, now the Cybercast News Service. And we're going to kick around a few of the issues of the day, including the one we just talked about. In our third hour, Shelley Kalinske is with us talking about how cell phones are microwaving your brain. And at the bottom of the hour, Larry Scott, the founder and editor of VA Watchdog, is going to drop by. And in that third hour, which would be 2:30 Eastern Time, 11:30 in the morning Pacific Time, I am going to be leaving for that last half hour of our show today, running out to the airport to catch a plane to San Francisco. And one of the finest progressive talk show hosts in America, Carl Wilson, who works with me here at AM 620 KPOJ, is going to be filling in for me. So you'll have an opportunity to say hi to Carl. And the final heads up, the third week of June, June 23rd through the 27th, we'll be doing this show live from the studios of Danish National Radio in Copenhagen. Scott McClellan's book is out. And in this context, I gotta, you know, put on my hat. In fact, I'm sitting here. I have my, I just pulled my license out of my wallet. Now, point of disclosure: this expired in 1998, on November 30th, 1998. And my license number was not, it says license number 097-0000571. State of Vermont, non-licensed, non-certified. See, psychiatrists are licensed, psychologists are certified, non-licensed, non-certified, psychotherapist. Signed by the Secretary of State. So I put on my official psychotherapist hat, even though I can't practice in this state and my license has expired. But nonetheless, let's say my talk show host, pseudo-psychotherapist hat, to make it totally legal. And I'm reading Scotty McClellan's book. And actually, I'm reading this Atlanta Constitution Journal article about Scotty McClellan's book that is quoting extensively from it, because I haven't Ken Herman write it for Cox News Service. And here's McClellan writing. He's somewhere in the Midwest. He's sitting in a hotel room. Bush is on the phone talking to a supporter. And Bush says, "The media won't let go of these ridiculous cocaine rumors. You know, the truth is, I honestly don't remember whether I tried it or not. We had some pretty wild parties back in the day, and I just don't remember." And now McClellan, writing in the book, in his own voice. McClellan says, "I remember thinking to myself, how can that be? How can someone simply not remember whether or not they used an illegal substance like cocaine? It didn't make a lot of sense." But McClellan suggests, and McClellan suggests, Bush isn't the kind of person to flat-out lie. So how does he get to a lie? So here, I'm quoting Scotty McClellan now. "So I think he meant what he said in that conversation about cocaine. It's the first time when I felt I was witnessing Bush convincing himself to believe something that was probably not true, and that deep down he knew was not true. And his reason for doing so is fairly obvious: political convenience." The article here by Ken Herman continues, "In the years that followed, McClellan," and then quoting McClellan again, "would come to believe that sometimes Bush convinces himself to believe what suits his needs at the moment. Bush similarly, quoting McClellan now, "similarly has a way of falling back on the hazy memory to protect himself from potential political embarrassment. In other words, being evasive is not the same as lying in Bush's mind. It would not be the last time Bush handled potential controversy," McClellan says, speaking of the cocaine rumors, "but the cases to come would involve the public trust," he's speaking of Iraq, obviously, "and the failure to deal with them early, directly, and head-on would lead to far greater suspicion and far more destructive partisan warfare." And on it goes. So let us not forget, and this is the one point I didn't see in Vincent Bugliosi's book, was why Bush, the main reason why Bush went into Iraq, and this is from 1999, before he was even running for president. He talked about how his father had gone into Iraq, or had fought, didn't go to Iraq. He fought Saddam Hussein up to his borders, and then he stopped. And as Cindy Sheehan testified before John Conyers' commission, under oath.
"As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalists and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, 'One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency,'" end quote.
The words of George W. Bush. 40 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number if you want to drop into our live chat room, tomhartmann.com. John in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, John.
Hey, a pirate once said, "Dead men tell no tales." And I agree that not only that George Bush is a murderer, but he attempted, if not outright, is assassinating this country. However, I don't believe he is acting alone, and I would like to ask Mr. Bugliosi who he suggests should be also prosecuted for aiding and abetting George Bush.
Yeah, it was a question. I mean, there was his book evokes so many questions, and that's certainly one that it would have been, and it's pronounced Bugliosi. That's one that certainly would have been appropriate to ask. I just didn't get to it. But clearly, this didn't happen in a vacuum. Just like the war crimes trials after World War II pointed out, you know, it didn't happen in a vacuum. So I think that, you know, we need to consider the whole bunch of them. Hank in Dorr, Michigan. Hey, Hank.
Yes, and just like your previous caller said, you know, you've got Cheney and Rumsfeld and Karl Rove, and let's run this all the way down into some of our senators and congressmen. You tell me some of these people don't know what's going on. And yeah. I think once they start, you know, the ball starts rolling from the top down, there's going to be a lot of people singing once they know they're going to prison.
Well, so, Bush, you're absolutely right. And a good prosecutor typically starts at the bottom and works their way up, and thus getting people to flip on the people above them. And so I would start with the National Security Council, the folks who saw that national intelligence estimate early on. And that, I'm assuming that would be, what, Condi Rice and Colin Powell and the, well, I don't have the list of the members of the NSC in front of me right now, but you know, that bunch, and of course the vice president and his number one aide. And so, yeah, good point, Hank, you know, spot on. David in Glendale, California. Hey, David.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Listen, two quick points. For 5 years, I've heard this imminent threat line.
Mm-hmm.
The line is, we have to stop him before he becomes an imminent threat.
What is this?
A little bit.
That's why Iraq is different from other.
What is this then? Listen.
First, I'm asked why Iraq is different from other countries or regimes that also have terrible weapons. While there are many dangers in the world, the threat from Iraq stands alone because it gathers the most serious dangers of our age in one place.
So, number one, it's the most dangerous threat in the world. And number two, can they attack us right now, Mr. Bush?
We've also discovered through intelligence that Iraq has a growing fleet of manned and unmanned aerial vehicles that could be used to disperse chemical or biological weapons across broad areas. We're concerned that Iraq is exploring ways of using these UAVs for missions targeting the United States.
The United States. Now, I don't have the audio of his speaking of the imminent threat, but Mr. Bugliosi has it. You know, he's got the transcripts in his books, and he didn't say before he's an imminent threat.
Yes, he did. I've heard the audio of it. I'm sorry I don't have it with me, but again, and by the way, as to his threats, John Hinderacher wrote a wonderful brief about all the attacks for like 18 years, going back to Lockerbie,
right.
And for the last 4 years, there have been none. There have been a few lone wolf operations. But there have been none. Again, what was he? Well, let's see. He made war on two of his countries. He provoked launched weapons of mass destruction. He launched unprovoked attacks on two other countries. And I'm just wondering, on one hand, Bush is this idiot, and on the other hand, he fools 16 intelligence agencies. Now, which is it? Is
he? I don't think he fooled them. I think he intimidated them, and I've never said he's an idiot. I have never said that. I don't believe that he's an idiot. I believe he's a sociopath with narcissistic personality disorder. He's a very, very sly man. He's a very smart man with a particular type of intelligence. It's not the kind of intelligence that gets you good grades at Harvard. But it's the kind of intelligence that Ted Bundy had. It's the kind of intelligence that Charles Manson had. And that's why I think it's quite interesting and appropriate in my mind that the man who prosecuted Charles Manson and then wrote the New York Times best-selling book Helter Skelter about that prosecution, that successful prosecution, now wants to prosecute George W. Bush and suggests that I don't know if he comes right out and says he's seen the same behavior, but he certainly, murder is murder, and that's what he's laying out. We'll be back with more of your calls right after this. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, tomhartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, airamerica.com for all things Air America. Stick around. We'll be right back. And, oh, and just a quick reminder, tomorrow night, you go to green960.com if you're in the San Francisco Bay Area and pick up all the information.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Indeed they are. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Strange stuff going on out there. Yeah, this is crazy, or is this a full monkey? Nude maid cleaned up good at a Florida man's home. According to the Associated Press, 50-year-old guy hires a maid from the internet on Friday to clean his suburban Tampa home. Paid her $100 an hour to do it without any clothes on. When his wife came home from vacation, she, of course, was out of the house. She discovered that $40,000 in jewelry was missing from their bedroom. Yeah, police are investigating, as they say. So, interesting. Okay, Bush, an imminent threat. Here's some quotes. If this threat is permitted, this is a quote from George W. Bush. Trusting in Hussein's restraint is not an option. One. Two, if this threat is permitted to fully and suddenly emerge, all actions, all words, and all recriminations would come too late. Trusting in the sanity and restraint of Saddam Hussein is not a strategy, and it is not an option. Another one. On July 2nd, 03, Saddam Hussein is no longer a threat to the United States because we removed him, but he was a threat. He's not an out threat. Ari Fleischer, on May 7th, 03, is Saddam Hussein an imminent threat? Ari Fleischer's answer, absolutely. Scott McClellan, February 10th, 03. This is about imminent threat. Speaking on behalf of the President of the United States. President Bush, on November 3rd, 02. Saddam Hussein is a threat to America. George W. Bush, 11-1-02. I see a significant threat to the security of the United States in Iraq. George W. Bush, October 28th, 02. This is a real threat, in my judgment, a real and dangerous threat to America in Iraq in the form of Saddam Hussein. George Bush, also October, no, not also, this is October 2nd, 02. The Iraq regime is a threat of unique urgency. George Bush on that same day. There is a grave threat in Iraq. There just is. On 9-26, 02, this man poses a much graver threat than anybody could have possibly imagined. And, of course, on and on it went, all the way up to the mushroom cloud.
Facing clear evidence of peril.
Clear evidence.
We cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
Amen. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, and David in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, David.
Tom, I love your show. I wish we could get more than an hour during the day.
Thank you. Well, actually, on your Chicago affiliate, we've moved up 3 hours, so you can get 3 hours of it even during the winter. But you're obviously listening online,
then,
so what's
and
up?
Then I called about. I have never heard a president refer to himself as commander-in-chief more often than George Bush has done than any of the presidents that I can ever remember before him.
Right. It's the only thing he's got. He thinks that his job is to be the head military guy, and he loves strutting around and, you know, on an aircraft carrier, you know, with a sock in his pants and the whole bit. I mean, you know, it's just it's a cheap shot. I'll retract that. But yeah, Bush is one of these conservatives who thinks that the only purpose of government is to punish. We have more people in prison in the United States, and this is a trend that really picked up under the Reagan administration. You can track it back to the Rockefeller drug laws that were first passed in New York State. We have more people in prison than any other country in the world in absolute numbers, and we're only 4% of the world's population, and in percentage numbers. And there's some pretty nasty dictatorships out there. I mean, this is just nuts. So it's wrong. Boris in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Boris.
Hello, Tom. I don't believe that the question is whether or not Bush and his associates have committed high crimes and misdemeanors. The question is, how can he be prevented from leaving the country once he leaves office? You probably know that the Bush family owns a large amount of acreage in Paraguay,
right,
and Paraguay has no extradition treaty with the United States.
I am familiar with that, yeah. And it's not a conspiracy theory, and although you can't read about it on the Internet. The best guess is that the land that they've bought, and it's something like 40,000 acres or something, some massive amount of land, is either over oil or water. I've read both, that there are, you know, but basically that it was an investment. But, you know, who knows? It may well be that that's his escape hatch. I wouldn't put it past him at all. And, yeah, the question is, how do you keep him in the United States? Or if he has to flee to Paraguay, I mean, geez, what a What an image that'll be for a president of the United States. Charlie in Freeport, Pennsylvania, listening to WPTT. Hey, Charlie.
Oh, man, I've been trying forever to get through to you, but at least I got through today. But I really wanted to talk about, everybody's in there blaming Congress for that. And, he is the head of the armed services. He's commander-in-chief as long as there's war, and it's his ultimate decision, no matter who else. We know there's a pile of generals and everything else involved in this.
Well, beyond that, the important point, Charlie, is that the intelligence service of the United States, all of them, 100% of the intelligence services of the United States, do not work for Congress. They work for the executive branch. There are three branches of government. They don't work for the judiciary. They don't work for the legislative. They work for the executive. And so they give their reports to the president, and then the president decides what of those reports it's appropriate to share with Congress. He's the decider in that
report. Exactly. Exactly. And another thing is, if you read what Congress had, I don't have it in front of me now, but it gives him the authorization if the U.N. did not, he never let the U.N. do what they were going to do. It's illegal even in the U.N.'s eyes.
Right. Yeah. Resolution 1991 or whatever it was, 11, I forget the number now, but it said that it had to go back to the Security Council. It had to be based on a finding by the folks at the IAEA and by Hans Blix. And Hans Blix, of course, was saying, no, we didn't see anything there. You know,
in the Middle Ages, when people were convinced they were witches, and then they looked for them, they certainly found them. And this is a bit risky. I think we were more judicious in saying that we want to have real evidence. And I'm not going to cite what the intelligence agencies are saying unless I have the evidence for it. If I had that, well, then I would do it.
And he never had that. There was never the evidence. And so he never gave that testimony before the UN, and so we were never authorized to go into Iraq. It was 6 months after the invasion of Iraq that the UN retroactively authorized the United States to have done what it did illegally. Coming up next, Terry Jeffrey with CNS News.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Tom Hartman.
Calling Bush a sociopath. You know, in his new book, I've got this fairly lengthy excerpt that was published in this morning's Atlanta Constitution Journal, where Scott McClellan talks about how Bush talks himself into a lie. He'll start repeating something over and over and over again that he knows not to be true. The example that McClellan uses in his book is his use of cocaine as a teenager. And in fact, there's considerable evidence. Hatfield, in his book, actually interviewed some of the people involved that when Bush was 19, 20 years old, something like that, he worked, and he talks about this in his autobiography, he worked for 30 days in a homeless shelter or something like that in downtown Dallas. And it was exactly 30 days. And he says he did it because he just felt an obligation to get to know the poor people. But in fact, apparently, he did it because he was arrested for cocaine. And that was what Alberto Gonzalez was expunging from his record when he had a brand new driver's license issued to him with a whole brand new number. And all of his previous records, including criminal records, vanished when he became governor of Texas.
Well, and that's not something that Scott McClellan says in his book.
No, that's in Hatfield's book, Fortunate Son.
That he doesn't have records of that. He's alleging that to be so, but he doesn't have these so-called police records and so forth.
No, but he's talking about, he's quoting Bush talking to a supporter on the phone. He says, Bush says, the media won't let go of these ridiculous cocaine rumors. You know, the truth is, I honestly don't remember whether I tried it or not. We had some pretty wild parties back in the day, and I just don't remember. And then McClellan writes, I remember thinking to myself, how can that be? How can someone simply not remember whether or not they use an illegal substance like cocaine? It didn't make a lot of sense. So I think he meant what he said in that conversation. It was the first time when I felt I was witnessing Bush convincing himself to believe something that probably was not true. The deep down he knew was not true. And his reason for doing so is fairly obvious, political convenience. Bush similarly has a way of falling back on a hazy memory to protect himself from potential political embarrassment.
Now, Tom, when did I haven't read McClellan's book and I haven't read that excerpt. When did McClellan say that event took place?
This would have been, I don't know.
Back during when Bush was first running for president, probably. I'm just guessing.
Yeah, this is, he says, when the then governor was dogged by possible reports of cocaine use. Yeah,
well, here's an interesting observation, then. I haven't read the book.
Yeah, neither have I.
Here's this guy, McClellan, all right, before he becomes a major player in the Bush White House, no one in the world knows who this guy is. He's an obscure person down in Texas. And he rides President Bush all the way into the White House and now to actual fame and probably fortune, I assume. And before he even went with this guy into the White House and took the position of being this person's spokesman to the world, he had this epiphany about George Bush. I would suggest that says as much about Scott McClellan as it says about George Bush.
You know, it's a tough one, Terry. I think that many people, when confronted with a choice between an opportunity to have a lot of money and power and prestige and perhaps violate their principles in ways that they can rationalize or not, will choose, particularly in our economy today, where if you're out of work, you don't have health insurance. If you get sick, you're going to die.
Right.
And not to portray Scotty McClellan as some sort of grand victim or something. I'm sure he could have found a decent job. But I think it's a lot easier than what you're suggesting. Or, last night on Fox News, I mean, basically what you're saying is the talking points that Hannity was using. Oh my God, if this guy, if Scotty McClellan is a sociopath, you're not Bush, because if he really believed this stuff back in the day, he would have said something. Well, I think anybody who's ever had a job and, doesn't like what their employer is doing but hasn't gone out and blown the whistle can probably identify with Scott McClellan.
Well, it may point to a bigger problem about our politics or something that involves American politics more than other walks of life, where most of us hope that people go into public life and are trying to advance public policy agendas that are going to affect everybody in the country, and people around the world are doing it out of a sincere interest to serve, to advance values that they really believe in, to work for people they believe in, who share their values and their causes, when in fact often you have people involved at the highest level of politics who are doing it because they want to advance themselves, they want to make more money, they want to become famous, they're willing to abandon those things they grew up believing,
right,
even the most profound principles maybe they were taught when they were growing up, in order to become someone that is famous and exalted in our country. And I think that's an unfortunate thing. And I think a tell-all book is symptomatic of that kind of phenomena, where someone even turns on the person who helped.
Maybe, but again, here, what you're trying to do is have us have a conversation about Scott McClellan, and I think that Scott McClellan is irrelevant.
Sure.
What's relevant is the man who's president of the United States, who Vincent Bugliosi, the guy who prosecuted Charlie Manson, it now has a book out called The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. I mean, a serious guy. And who lays out a prosecutor's brief and has prosecutors all over the United States planning on prosecuting George Bush as soon as he gets out of office for the murder of the soldiers who died from their states.
Well, that's completely absurd. I mean, first of all, the war in Iraq was authorized by Congress.
Whether no, it was not.
Yeah, it absolutely was, Tom.
Let's say it was with a caveat. And the caveat was that Bush had to write a letter to Congress within 90 days of the commencement of hostilities, asserting that there was a direct connection between Saddam Hussein and 9/11. And Bush actually wrote that letter.
No,
you can find it. No, you can find the letter over at WhiteHouse.gov.
Tom, I've read the war resolution over and over again. I'm very familiar with the constitutional powers of the Congress and the President. There's absolutely no question that Congress authorized the use of force in Iraq, and that at the time that no one doubted that Congress had done that. And whether that was a wise thing or not, they did it.
Sean, can you quickly lay your hands on that? We did an entire show on this where we have the war resolution and then we have the letter that Bush wrote. If I can get it quickly, Terry, trust me, I'm telling you the truth on this. If you actually read the war resolution, if Bush, this is the infamous one that Hillary Clinton voted for and Barack Obama said he would have voted against, right? And that John Edwards apologized. It says in there, if Bush commences hostilities, he has 90 days to write a letter to Congress saying that he had proof connecting Saddam Hussein to 9/11. And he wrote the letter.
The war resolution was not in any way contingent on 9/11.
It was.
The war resolution was based on the wrong-headed belief that Saddam Hussein had violated the ceasefire agreements he made via the UN.
Terry, trust me, you haven't read this thing recently.
I have read it. I've read the congressional debates. I followed it very closely at the time. And there's absolutely no doubt what it was predicated. It was not predicated on 9/11.
Okay, then let's just for a moment assume that it was not. It was predicated then on lies from the Bush administration. When George Bush, again, Bugliosi lays this out, when Bush came before the American people in October of 2002 and said that Saddam Hussein and Iraq represented a threat to the United States. He had been told 4 days earlier in a national intelligence estimate, which has since been declassified, but oddly enough, as Bugliosi points out, has never appeared in any American newspaper. He was told explicitly that Iraq represented no threat whatsoever. And now we're seeing the same thing in Iran. I mean, here the Asia Times is reporting that two key senators, and the two senators are Dianne Feinstein and Richard Lugar, the Republican of Indiana, are going to write an op-ed piece in the New York Times expressing their opposition to Bush attacking Iran because they say that he's planning on going after Iran. A retired U.S. career diplomat and former Assistant Secretary of State, still active in foreign affairs, said last week that the U.S. plans an airstrike against the Quds Force, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. Yesterday we had Michael Ledeen on this show, who was the essentially Doug Feist's assistant, the number two guy, and he refused to deny to, you know, he said we should attack the terrorists in Iran.
Well, look,
I said, does that include the Quds Force? He says we should attack the terrorists.
Look, Iran is a different issue, and I do believe, as a conservative and someone who believes in the Constitution, the President of the United States does not have unilateral authority to preemptively attack another country, with the sole exception of a need. An urgent need to prevent an attack against the United States. So George Bush cannot just attack Iran without the authority of Congress. That's a simple constitutional fact. But Tom,
the Senate, this is this was 74-22, this vote. The Senate has declared the Quds Force a terrorist group, and Bush has agreed.
It doesn't matter. The president cannot attack a terrorist group unless it's going to attack the United States without the authority of Congress.
Well, you and I would hope so. Terry, can you stick around? We'll continue this conversation. And I think I've got the information here. We'll be right back. Terry Jeffrey is with us. He is the editor-in-chief of CNSNews.com. Our number, 866-303-2270, TomHartmann.com, and AirAmerica.com. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartmann Program. The true people's radio. Tom Hartmann.
Past the hour, Tom Hartmann radio program. We're talking with Terry Jeffrey, the editor-in-chief at CNSNews.com. And, Terry, I've tracked this stuff down. There's a whole lot of things I want to talk with you about, you know, from the same-sex marriage thing in California to Hillary to Iran and whatnot. But I just want this to be on the record. You might want to make some notes here. October 2nd, 2002. You can find this at the White House. I'm looking at the WhiteHouse.gov website. This is not some liberal blog. This is the actual
right.
White House website over the letterhead of President George W. Bush. First of all, this is from the office, the joint resolution to authorize the use of the United States Armed Forces against Iraq. That's what I'm looking at. Okay.
Right.
This is the piece of legislation that was signed. Section 3. Okay. Section 3 is titled Authorization for Use of United States Armed Forces. Authorization. The president is authorized to use the armed forces of the United States as he determines to be necessary and appropriate in order to defend and enforce blah, blah, blah. Presidential determination, in connection with the exercise of the authority granted in subsection A to use force, the president shall, prior to such exercise or as soon as thereafter may be feasible, but no later than 48 hours after exercising such authority, make available to the Speaker, House of Representatives, and the President pro tem of the Senate his determination that acting pursuant to this resolution is consistent with the United States and other countries continuing to take the necessary actions against international terrorists and terrorist organizations, including those nations, organizations, or persons who planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11, 2001.
Right.
Now, that's the determination. Here's the letter that Bush wrote, dated March 18, 2003. Dear Mr. Speaker, consistent with Section 3B, blah, 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 I determined that, acting pursuant to the Constitution and Public Law 107-243, which I just read from you, is consistent with the United States and other countries continuing to take the necessary actions against international terrorists and terrorist organizations, including those nations, organizations, or persons who planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11, 2001. Sincerely, George W. Bush.
Right. And I'm looking at this language right now on the United States Senate website, the exact language you read, which says, acting pursuant to this joint resolution is consistent with the United States and other countries continuing to take necessary actions against international terrorists and terrorist organizations. It doesn't say that it is predicated upon. It is just not inconsistent with the president's judgment. So it's not.
We're splitting hairs here, Terry. The bottom line is he was using 9/11 as a pretext to invade Iraq.
But Tom, that's not what the plain language of this says. I'm reading it myself on the Senate website, where they listed it as it was passed by both houses of Congress. And it's not even exclusive to those terrorist organizations that perpetrated 9/11. It says, including those nations, organizations, or persons who planned, authorized, or committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11, 2001. So the plain meaning of that language is they're asking the president to say that using this military force against Iraq because of the things we say Iraq has done, which admittedly were erroneous, was not inconsistent with our continuing actions against international terrorist organizations, including those.
Terry, 100,000 people are dead.
Right.
I mean, dead. Imagine a member of your family, your mother, your father, a brother, a child, dead. 100,000 people are dead. And we're arguing over whether the language was, you know, the minutia of the language. This guy lied us into a war. You just said it. You said the intelligence was wrong. The intelligence was not wrong. When Bush in October said that Iraq represented a threat, it was 4 days after he was told by his own intelligence services, the total consensus in the NIE, that there was no threat.
Well, wait a minute, Tom. First of all, this language is not a small matter. This language is a matter of a resolution that the United States Congress passed to authorize the country to go to war. And people can look it up in the congressional record and see the exact language, which is the language that you read and the language that I'm looking at right now on my computer screen. And it does not say that the war is predicated on Iraq having an involvement in September.
It says it's consistent with it. I'll agree with you.
It says that acting pursuant to the resolution, which is based on the intelligence about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, is not inconsistent with.
Right.
That's because, and so that Bush made that judgment. Was that judgment wrong-headed? Perhaps. Was the intelligence wrong?
Was that judgment a crime? Yes.
No, if Bush was lying, it's an impeachable offense.
It's not just an impeachable offense. It is criminal murder. It is incitement to murder. This man has ordered, you know, war,
Tom,
Terry, is legalized mass murder.
Tom, and that, it's not legalized mass murder if you're acting in self-defense and you're proportional and discriminating.
That is legalized murder as well, self-defense.
The National Intelligence Estimate of Record, which was requested by Senator Feinstein, Senator Durbin, and some others prior to this vote, was specifically to see what the factual predicate was in terms of the best thinking of the intelligence community for people to make this vote.
That's
that
right.
National intelligence estimate is only a matter of record. It's been investigated inside and out. We all know what it said, and yes, it was wrong.
And no, wait a second. As Vince Bugliosi points out in his new book, that record that was made public by the Bush administration at the request of Feinstein and others omitted the paragraphs that were in the top secret one, which was declassified after 2004, which said that Iraq represented no threat and had no weapons of mass destruction. No, they deliberately omitted it.
Wait a minute, Tom. They had the members of the United States had complete access to all the most highly classified intelligence. In fact, there's only six members of the United States Senate, and Harry Reid wasn't one of them, and Hillary Clinton wasn't one of them, actually bothered to go to the room where they could actually read the full estimate before they voted for the war.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to resolve this, Terry. But it's a good conversation. Terry Jeffries, CNSNews.com. Thanks for dropping by, Terry. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Yeah, time for a whole bunch of changes. 34 minutes past the hour. And time for our conservative. Yeah, they didn't like Starbucks because the logo was too sexual. You'll recall that little segment that we had here on the program. And so they all went to Dunkin' Donuts, and now Dunkin' Donuts is running an ad with Rachel Ray wearing a very kind of cool-looking, hip, nice, whatever the right phrase is, kind of scarf. But Michelle Malkin has decided this is the traditional scarf of Arab men that has come to symbolize murderous Palestinian jihad. And so Dunkin' Donuts is now caved to the conservative blogosphere and removed their ad. This is totally bizarre. This is totally bizarre. This is a Rorschach test. I mean, these people are seeing, I mean, it's like in the 50s we were seeing commies under every bed, and now we're seeing jihadis on every TV ad. It's sick, sad, and twisted. I don't know how to describe it beyond that. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Steve in Monterey, California, listening on KRXA. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Thanks, Tom. Listen, on the network news, I've heard the soundbite of Bill several times this morning saying he doesn't get it, why so many are clamoring for Hillary to withdraw. And personally, I avoided Bill's 96th convention speech because I'd figured out even back then that Mr. I Didn't Inhale never did get it. And I just wish he could be made to go sit in a corner of America somewhere with a dunce cap on until he gets it.
Well, I think his wife is kind of stifling him, as it were. I mean, Bill got out there a little too far for a while. But the reality is, to the best of my knowledge, Barack Obama has said that she has every right to campaign, right, as, you know, as long as she wants. And he has not sewn this thing up yet, although he's... You know, it certainly looks like it's obvious that it's going to happen. I think it's fairly obvious it's going to happen, but he has not. And so, you know, if Obama says she has every right to keep on campaigning, then in my opinion, well, not that he's the arbiter of it, but then in my opinion, how can a campaign say that the opposing campaign is saying that they should stop when the opposing campaign isn't saying that they should stop? And by and large, the news media, with the singular exception of one statement by Keith Olbermann, for which he later apologized, by and large, to the best of my knowledge, the news media has not called for her to pull out either. So, I agree with you. I don't get it. Richard in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Richard.
Hi, Tom. How are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Tom, I'd like to make a statement, and then I'd like to ask a comment. One, I fully supported the war in Iraq, and it had nothing to do with terrorism. It had nothing to do with 9/11. Our trading partners, France and Germany, allied with Saddam, and they were trading oil in euros, and which would undermine the American economy. That's why Bush had no choice but to go in and attack Saddam and take him out, just like he wants to do with Iran.
It wasn't that much oil, Richard. It wasn't that much oil, although, you know, I...
No, it had to do with the American dollar.
No, I mean, there wasn't so much oil that it could destabilize the dollar. The threat was the entire world going off the dollar. But we have to ask ourselves the question, Richard. As I pointed out earlier, war is legalized mass murder. We've got 100,000 dead people, all to protect the dollar.
Yes, sir.
You would agree with that? You would support that?
I don't agree with it. I think it's terrible. But I honestly think that it was just they were undermining the American economy.
And that's worth killing people for.
I'm sorry, sir?
And that's worth killing people for.
Listen, Tom, I'm not in favor of it. I just understand it.
Well, no, you said you supported the war. I mean, would you say if Canada decided that we were undermining their economy and they came down here and they killed your family, would you say, well, hey, we were undermining their economy?
I think it was wrong, but I understand why we went to war, and I supported the idea of going to war to keep the American economy strong.
Why would you support that? Why would you say that keeping an economy strong is worth killing people over?
Because if we undermine the American economy, how many more millions would we be killing by the destruction of the American dollar?
None. The American dollar has been destroyed. Bush has been president for 7 years, and the American dollar is worth about a third right now of what it was when he came into office. I remember when you could buy, you know, it was like 3 marks. Well, this was back Deutschmarks, but, you know, I remember when...
We're going to war with Iran, Tom. We're going to war with Iran because Iran's selling oil outside of the dollar.
I don't think so. I think we're going to a war with Iran because Bush thinks it's going to help him. It's probably the only thing that will help get John McCain elected president.
Oh, that's a horrible thought.
I believe that this is all about political calculus. In 1999, Bush told his biographer, Mickey Herskowitz, who was a 20-year family friend of the Bush family. This guy was in tight with the Bush family, and he wrote Bush's autobiography, A Charge to Keep, which you can buy in a bookstore today. This was the ghostwriter of his autobiography. He told him, and Herskowitz is on the record as saying this, he told him that if he was elected president, this was before he'd even officially announced that he was going to run, that if he was elected president, that he was going to go to war in Iraq. And the reason why was because he would get so much political capital that he would be able to privatize Social Security and accomplish all the other things on his agenda. You'll recall when he ran for Congress in 77 from Texas, his main agenda, in fact, his sole platform was privatizing Social Security.
Tom, it's a sad state of affairs. I really enjoy listening to you.
Well, thank you, Richard. I appreciate the call. I understand that, you know, people are concerned about our economy. I understand that they're concerned about the dollar. And I understand that there's a theory out there that Bush attacked Iraq because Iraq was talking about because Hussein was talking about denominating his oil in euros. You recall a couple of weeks before the attack, Hussein actually came out and said, I will only sell oil in dollars if that will satisfy the United States. And we said, no, that won't satisfy it. I believe, and I absolutely believe this to be true, because all the evidence seems to point to this, that the reason George Bush went to war is because he and Karl Rove decided that that would be the thing that would give the Republican Party a permanent majority in the House, the Senate, and the White House, that it would create single-party rule in the United States. And they were talking about it. They were bragging about it. They were talking about the permanent Republican majority. That's why they went to war, in my humble opinion. Peter in Los Angeles listening on K-Talk. Hey, Peter.
Hi, Tom. I'm both disturbed by what your guest this morning, Mr. Jeffrey, said, and by what the previous caller said. So many Americans say, you know, we're proud of a competitive free market, you know, and we want fair competition. But if we're not competing well, do we attack another country because of monetary issues? I don't know. That just freaks me out a little bit.
See, I think it's a reflection. You know, I don't think that our last caller was an evil person or anything like that. I think it's a reflection of how bizarre our worldview has become in America, in the United States, as a consequence of media that hypes war as if it was a video game. I mean, we have come to think of war as a video game. In the United States, this is an amazing thing. Amy Goodman, you know, Democracy Now!, which is a marvelous news show. Amy Goodman does this, or was doing, I don't know if she's still doing it, but back years ago, I saw her, in fact, she and I shared a stage, and she did this presentation, a video or slideshow presentation, where she was showing the coverage of the first weeks of the Iraq war on CNN National, U.S., and CNN International. And on CNN International, CNN was showing the bodies. They were showing children that were dead. They were showing people laying in the street. They were showing buildings blown up that were obviously homes and residences. On CNN National in the U.S., they were showing these video games of laser-guided bombs going down chimneys and computer-simulated things and cockpit shots, but they never once showed a body. It was night and day, and this was the same coverage of the same war on the same day in the same hour.
Right, right. The other thing is, your guest this morning, Mr. Jeffries, I think he's totally ignoring what the historical facts were, and that was that the Bush administration purposefully conflated weapons of mass destruction and the so-called connection to 9/11 to get the public and therefore Congress to cave into the authorization for war.
Point.
And so for him to parse, it's not predicated upon, but it's consistent with. I think one of the reasons why they wrote it that way was frankly to give the right the same plausible deniability that he himself was using, which is no, it wasn't predicated on it, you know, as long as it's, you know, not inconsistent with. But
in other words, you think that Congress was covering their butts as much as Bush?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I Peter, I'm inclined to agree with you. Thanks a lot for the call and for pointing that out. That was an excellent point. Lee in Michigan, listening on WDTW. Hey, Lee.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Just great, but I'll get better. How about you?
I'm in the same position. Listen, I wanted to make a comment that kind of ties into some of yours in the last half hour regarding the war and what I think is the real shame of Memorial Day, is that nobody's noticed especially all the patriots in this country, how the U.S. military has, for all practical purposes, been wasted by being sent on a fool's errand.
Yeah.
And you don't send young people whose blood you really treasure on a fool's errand where they really weren't going to do any good, let alone spend the treasure that you spend and further decimate your economy if you really care about America.
Right. Yeah. Well said, Lee. And in fact, let me just put a punctuation point on that. We are spending a couple of $1 trillion on this war in Iraq. And so, and we're borrowing all of the money. 100% of the money that is being spent in Iraq is money that we are borrowing. And we are borrowing it from Saudi Arabia and from China, countries that are not exactly interested in operating in our best interest. So it's not about, you know, is this good for our economy or not? It's bad for our economy. This is a terrible thing for our economy. This is going to create mind-boggling inflation, just like the last 5 years of the Vietnam War being run in almost entirely on credit, entirely on borrowed money, caused 10, 15 years later when those bonds started coming due, caused U.S. inflation rates to hop up to 17, 18%. We're going to see that again soon.
Tom Hartman, helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. I can tell you, I mentioned on the air sometime back that I'd always been fascinated by the culture of long-haul truckers. Back the days when I was a country western DJ, and then I did rock and roll for years. But Richard Ide sent me a book, Three Aces, and I'm about a third of the way through it. It's a great novel. This is really a great novel. I just want to tell you about it. Number three, acesthenovel.com. is the website if you share my fascination with this. And thank you, Richard, for sending that to me. Ellen Ratner on the line with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
And I'm almost halfway done with your book, The Prophet's Way, and I have enjoyed every minute of it.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you.
Several things going on today. I guess I want to start out with the Scott McClellan book, which is not going to be released supposedly till Monday, although I think they're going to probably tell the booksellers that they can sell it now, being that the Politico went out and bought one and broke the story. And essentially the White House is now saying through Fran Townsend, who was on CNN, and a statement released by Dana Perino, that, you know, first of all, Scott wasn't that involved, and secondly, that he, they're saddened that he found he needed to do this. Well, I mean, first of all, just on a human-to-human basis, how do you cut somebody out, make them be your flack, don't give them information, and then expect them not to, and then kick them out, and then expect them not to say what's going on?
Yeah. Well, what we have here, Ellen, is a classic case of kill a messenger. They have no interest in discussing the actual merits or demerits of what is being charged in the book. Rather, they want to talk about whether or not Scott McClellan is a reasonable source. This is the same thing that they did to Paul O'Neill. It's the same thing they did to Richard Clark. It's the same. I mean, every single time somebody comes up.
And it's the old disgruntled employee routine.
Yeah, yeah, it's kill a messenger. Yeah. In fact, Dana Perino this morning said disgruntled employee. I've got the...
Right.
The news release around here someplace. I don't know. We're in my pile of stuff. But, yeah. Yeah. So.
And what's interesting is I was actually at Scott McClellan. The White House has sort of divided the press room into the top floor, which is mainly print and the big networks, and bottom floor, which is like CNN, the radio people, and a couple of print magazines, but it's mainly radio and CNN, Bloomberg, and that group.
And Talk Radio News.
And what we get, the basements are all always give the party. So we gave a going away party for Scott. And there were, they had, we had, signs from his mother's campaign for governor.
Mm-hmm.
Which of course was not supported by any of the Bush people. They supported Rick Perry. And, Scott, I have to tell you, I just remember that day. It was painful because he was putting on his best game face and you just knew the guy was furious and really feeling out there. And as I've learned in this business, as I'm sure you have, and particularly after reading The Prophet's Way, you got to trust your gut. And my gut just said, something is not right here.
Yeah. Well, you know, with Scott McClellan's, that's interesting. I had forgotten that his mother ran for governor and Rick Perry won against her. And that was the election right at, that was 2000, wasn't it?
Yeah, that, well.
Or was it 2002? What year was
Rick
that?
Perry came in as the lieutenant, and so he was automatically governor, and then Scott's mom ran against her, and she'd been the state controller.
Okay, so this would have been 2002 or something like that, or 2004?
Four.
So that was...
Oh, and Texas may be an off-year governorship. Somewhere.
Well, I guess here's my question. Was his mother running for governor while he was press secretary for the president, and the president was supporting his mother's opponent?
Yeah.
Wow, that's got to be tough.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's got to be a very tough. You know, that's very
and
odd.
Scott had run three of his mother's campaigns.
Wow, and he participated in George's campaign. You know.
Right.
So, interesting. Do you think that, you know, I mean, you knew Scott McClellan. What's your sense of him in terms of his, you know, let's use the right-wing frame for a moment, his credibility to write this book?
Well, first of all, I know Scott to be personally the nicest human being on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
He would not harm a fly, and he was exceedingly physically uncomfortable in his body when he was spinning for the White House.
Yeah.
And you could tell. I mean, you did not have to be an expert. I mean, you with your NLP stuff, I would love you to just review some of the tapes
of
him spinning, and I think you would see the same thing that we saw.
Yeah.
The guy was either a poor orator, and that was the official word, or he was just uncomfortable being who he was and doing having. So I would trust what Scott said.
Yeah. Yeah,
he has no reason to make things up, and frankly, I don't think that's Scott's personality.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be interesting because one of the things that he pointed out in the book was that Rove and Libby were conspiring to get their stories straight. He didn't use the words conspiring, but were getting their stories straight about Valerie Plame. That's a criminal conspiracy to obstruct justice. That's a felony. And he lays it out in his book, and he uses the word lie. I mean, I wonder if Patrick Fitzgerald or some grand jury or some prosecutor someplace, although I think it would have to be the Justice Department, so it probably won't happen, but if somebody's going to take what Scott wrote in his book and say, okay, let's reopen this thing.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. So,
it'll be very interesting. There's other interesting news, but one thing that really stands out today, you know, the White House puts out their spin, et cetera. One of the spins that they're putting out, there's two scare tactics, safety and our safety as a country, and the other is taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And they're putting out saying that by letting the Bush tax cuts expire, Americans are looking at the greatest tax hike in recent history.
Yeah, right.
And that's the spin they're putting out because they're trying to scare us again.
Well, if they want to go to the greatest tax hike in recent history, they should go back to Reagan doubling the FICA tax on working people and not on anybody else.
Well, how about taking off the tax credit I got for putting solar energy in my house?
There you go. Ellen Radner, talkradionews.com is the website for the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Ellen, the big cheese there. Ellen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman. Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
PRNews.com and has a product that he sells over at Waveshield.com. And this interview is in no way an endorsement of that product. Let me just lay that right out for everybody to hear. Shelley, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
You asked the question, would you stick your head in a microwave oven? I, a month or three ago, We did a story on this program about the study that came out of Denmark indicating that there seemed to be a statistical correlation between cell phone use and brain cancers. And there have been numerous studies around the world showing that radiation at the levels produced by cell phones produce cellular abnormalities in vitro. You want to amplify on that, or is there something new? What's going on here?
Well, I created the CPRnews.com, and under World News, there's over 150 studies on cell phone dangers. And by the way, not one study is from the United States, because it's big business.
Right. And, well, it's big business all over the world, actually.
Yes, but there's studies mostly from Europe. And there's just more and more studies coming out. I mean, the last 2 weeks have just been unbelievable. The tumors are right behind the ear. When you place the phone directly against your inner ear, the radiation is going into all the nerves and blood cells, and that's where the reports of tumors and health problems are, right behind the ear.
Right.
I'm currently getting 15 to 20 reports of tumors a week just talking to people who know people.
Yeah.
And the forecast is by 2015, we're going to have up to 500,000 brain tumors a year from cell phone and cordless phone use.
Cordless phones as well. Cordless phones, I thought, produced a whole lot less radiation at a much lower frequency.
They used to, Tom. Years ago, they were a weak radio signal. If you left the room or went outside, you lost the call.
Right.
Now, you can be a block and a half from the base, you don't lose the call.
But an 800 megahertz phone, which is the frequency range that cell phones used to use, or cordless phones used to use, that's not microwave. For microwaves, you have to get into the gigahertz range.
They're into 5 gigs now.
They are?
Yeah.
Okay. And what's the frequency range for cell phones?
I'm not sure. One of the questions people ask me, Shelley, I need to buy a phone. Where can I find information on which are the highest and lowest?
Right.
For your listeners, there is...
No, I'm not talking about radiation levels. I'm talking about frequency, the actual number of cycles per second, hertz per second.
I don't know that.
Okay, all right.
But there's a website called CNET, CNET.com.
Right.
So if you're buying a new phone, they list the highest, they list every manufacturer, the highest and lowest radiation levels.
Right, right. Now, I remember when cell phones first came out, I had a bag phone, then I had a brick phone. Then I got one of the very first portables. At that time, phones were entirely analog. And so for an analog phone, it had to maintain a really intense signal with the base. And I remember holding that thing. My index finger and my thumb would actually, the skin on them would get like leather.
Wow.
And the side of my head would get hot. I remember that. You know, I used a fair amount. I don't experience that so much now with a digital phone. The digital signal seems to be probably at least an order of magnitude less intense. The batteries certainly last much longer, which would indicate that. Have we reached the point now where the cancers that we're going to be seeing are the consequence of people who were using, like I was, the analog cell phones? Or are you suggesting that the modern digital cell phones that are using a fraction of the energy or emitting a fraction of the energy that was emitted by the analog phones just a couple of years ago are also problematic?
Well, they are, and what's happening is there's more and more microwave towers going up. People are using cell phones much longer. You know, I tell people cut out non-essential calls, but they live on the phone looking for a call, waiting for a call. Children who are at the greatest risk because their brain tissue is still developing, so the radiation goes deeper into their brain, they're on those phones talking day and night. So it's the amount of usage, and over time, like normal studies have shown over a 10-year period what the effects are going to be. But that is now changing as people are using the phones much more. I was talking to a gentleman the other day, and he asked me what I did, and I told him, he said, oh, my God, my wife is a real estate agent. She lives on the cell phone and cordless phone. She has a tumor behind her ear. And I'm hearing this every day now.
Wow. Now, you know, obviously you have some products over at your website, waveshield.com, that purport to reduce or eliminate the danger of radiation. Do I have that right?
Yeah, what happened very quickly, I found material in Asia after watching a show in 2020 in the fall of 99 on cell phone dangers, and the material, I tested it, and it blocked 99% of the radiation from penetrating the material. I got the material in January of 2000, I made the first wave shield, sent it to a U.S. government-approved lab to test on phones. Now, when a call comes in off your antenna, and half the radiation goes back into space. The rest forms around the side of the head where you hold the phone against your ear and runs through the body of the phone. The wave shield does not block that. What we're blocking only is the radiation that comes through the holes.
Why not just hold up a piece of tinfoil next to your head?
I'm sorry?
Why not just hold up a piece of tinfoil next to your head?
Well.
I'm serious. I'm an old ham radio operator. I know about radio waves.
You understand.
I mean,
so the radiation is going into the ear. See, the ear is the highest absorption rate of radiation in the body, and this is where most of the reports of tumors and health problems are, directly behind the ear. So
right.
That was our focus. So we're the wave shield. I make a silver one that blocks up to 97% of that radiation going into your ear. And I make a larger silver one for cordless phones, of which I'm on now all day, that blocks up to 97%.
Right.
And I make a 24-karat gold cover one that blocks up to 99% for cell phones.
Now, how would gold block?
Well, I didn't know. What happened, Tom? There was interest in Europe for gold, so I covered it. This is eight years ago. I covered it with 24-karat gold, sent it to the U.S. lab, and it blocked 2% higher. And then I sent it to Cetacom Germany, the highest testing authority in Europe, and they approved it so I can put CE on the packaging in Europe. And then the Russian Health Department did their own independent test because I had a distributor there, and they approved WaveShield for sale in the Federation of Russia.
Now, there are some folks who think that putting an earphone in their cell phone will solve their problem, but the earphone wire then becomes simply an antenna, and although the major radiation source is no longer right up against their head, the earpiece is deeper inside their ear than the phone would be. But there now are a number of companies that are selling headphones where the actual device that converts the electrical energy into audio is a foot or so away from the earphone, and what runs to the earphone is actually a piece of plastic tube, basically a little plastic pipe that carries sound. That would keep the radiation away from the head effectively, would it not?
You're absolutely right. In fact, I do carry one like that that's radiation-free.
Right.
It's a blue tube, just like a stethoscope, so only air and sound goes into your ear. See, the regular wired headsets conduct up to 3 times more radiation into your ear. Studies have been done in Europe. And the Bluetooth, a very popular product with no cord, people love it. The signal from the phone is carrying radiation right into your ear. They're very dangerous.
But Bluetooth is you know, again, a cell phone has to transmit a signal
right.
with enough intensity that a tower 5-10 miles away can pick it up.
Exactly.
That's a hell of a output. That's a couple hundred, you know, probably a couple hundred milliwatts, I would think at the top end anyway. You know, it's a fair amount of energy. Bluetooth only has to transmit 5-10 feet. That's probably, you know, less than a milliwatt, microwatts. So why would Bluetooth be dangerous?
Well, they did studies in Europe. They just said the signal going from the phone is carrying radiation right into your ear, plus the antenna.
How does the phone, if the phone is radiating radiation to the tower, and it's also radiating a secondary signal at a different frequency to the Bluetooth device, it seems like that, you know, the Bluetooth device is the thing in your ear. That's just talking to your phone. That's not generating a lot of energy.
But that signal is coming right from the cell phone.
It's not the same signal that's going to the tower.
Well, the tower is carrying the signal to your phone, and that same signal is going from the phone right into your...
No, it's not the same signal. With a Bluetooth-enabled phone, it's a different signal at a different frequency at a lower power level.
Well, as I say, I read the studies. I'm not an engineer. I read the studies coming out of Europe, and they indicated that it was a dangerous product to use.
Yeah, interesting.
And I have testing from that.
Interesting. So stay with the plastic tube and tell your friends not...
Plastic tube because it's only air and sound going up to the ear, zero radiation.
Yeah. You know, I can't say that I have any familiarity at all with your products. So we're talking with Shelly Kalnitsky of waveshield.com. But I am familiar with these studies. I have been following this stuff for years, and I share your opinion, if I don't know if you'd put it in these words, that cell phones of today, or at least of a decade ago and probably of today, are the cigarettes of 50 years ago, the things that everybody thought were ubiquitous and safe, and we're going to find out they're not. So Shelly, thanks a lot for coming by.
Thanks for having me on the show, Tom.
CPRnews.com, waveshield.com. Interesting conversation. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
Listen up. A little bit softer now.
a little bit softer now, a little bit softer now, a little bit softer now, a little bit louder now, a little bit louder now, a little bit louder now.
21 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman Radio Program brought to you in part by the Teamsters, fighting to stop the unfair trade deal with Colombia. Find out more at Teamster.org. Proud to be supported by labor here, speaking from behind the good old working-class stainless steel microphone. Carl Wolfson will be joining us at the bottom of the hour. He'll be talking to Larry Scott in the first segment, and then picking up your calls, I believe, in the second. Our number, 866-303-2270. And Dennis in San Jose, California. Hey, Dennis, what's up?
Hey, yeah, I had a funny story about CNN. You mentioned the International National, and I used to be media director for some progressive nonprofits. Mm-hmm. And I was at CNN Studios, and they actually have, in the lobby, you watch them recording both shows. The National and International are done in the exact same place. You can mm-hmm. see them back to back.
Right, in Atlanta.
Exactly. So I asked them specifically why the news was different. What they put out on CNN International is the same as on why it's different on International and National. And they said, well, if we put the stuff that we put on nationally, internationally, no one would watch it because they wouldn't believe it. So the second question I asked them,
And the flip side of it is if they put the international on the national, they believe that the average American wouldn't watch it because they'd be bored by news about what's going on in Bangladesh.
Well, I asked that question, and I said, why can't you give people in the U.S. the option of choosing for one or the other? Right. Because at that time, at least, you could not get CNN International in the United States, and they just said, no, this is the news that we think the people want to see here.
Right.
But
well, actually,
do.
The main reason is that the networks pay for the channel, and then they've got to, you know, they've got to hit a certain minimum threshold of viewers before they've paid off their use of that channel, and channel space is pretty hard to come by and pretty expensive, and so they probably pretty much had to make a decision, one channel or the other.
But what I was amazed was is they knew. It wasn't like, well, gee, we just didn't understand. I mean, they were back-to-back, so they're saying one version of the news here, something sometimes completely different on the right-hand side, which is the international side, and they knew it.
Yeah.
For U.S. consumption, we're lying to you.
I don't think that they would characterize those terms, but for U.S. consumption, it's a different story. Good point, Dennis. Thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, I've been down there and seen. In fact, I've been on CNN, and funny story. In fact, I in addition to being on CNN a couple of times, one time this was back when the Lorena Bobbitt trial was happening, and I had just written one of my books on ADD had come out, and I was living in Atlanta at the time, and they had booked me to be a guest on the morning show. It's Sylvia or whatever his name was. And the producer, you know, I went in the day before and we did a kind of a rehearsal, you know, and everything. And then the next morning, I was supposed to be there at 6 o'clock in the morning. At 5 o'clock in the morning or 4:30, I get a call from the producer and she says, you know, I'm calling to tell you that we're going to have to cut your segment this morning. We're just going to have to cut it right out altogether because the Lorena Bobbitt trial is going live and we're going to just run that trial, you know, back to back. And then she pauses for a minute and laughs and says, I guess you could say you're the second man cut by Lorena Bobbitt. So. If you're old enough to remember the story, it's a good one. Anyhow, Kim in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Kim, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on. I'm a nurse, and I don't do my job because I'm going to get rich doing it.
I don't think any nurses do.
Pardon me?
I don't think any nurses do.
Right. We don't make big money, but it's better than Burger King, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, I'm out there every day. I'm a home health nurse. I drive 400 miles a week, which, you know, my own personal family story and everything we've lost because of all the high prices and all of that is sort of irrelevant to my point here. But I'm seeing people out there that are choosing to eat rather than buy their medications.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, with all of this corporate greed and pharmacy, I mean, I don't know. As the rich get richer and the poor get poorer and I see people suffering, I don't know how people don't see this around them every day.
Yeah.
Isn't this what revolutions are made out of?
It is. It has to get a whole lot worse. If you go back and look at the history of the French Revolution, things were really, really bad in the 2 years before the French Revolution. And finally, the year that the French Revolution happened, they were having bread riots in Paris. Literally every time a baker would start baking bread, people would smell it. Thousands of people would show up and they would, you know, they'd tear the place apart just to get the food. People were starving. That's what it took in France to trigger the French Revolution. I think that rather than revolutions being brought about by hard times, because I can tell you, I've been in a lot of third world countries where it's one hell of a lot worse than it'll ever get here in the United States. In Haiti, for example, or several African countries, even some South American countries, it's pretty rough, or places, parts of South American countries. I think that it's a matter of political will. I think it's a matter of people, you know, when the American Revolution was not conducted in a context of privation. The American Revolution was conducted in the context of political activism. And whether we're talking about armed and violent revolution, which hopefully we'll never see again in the United States, or whether we're talking about genuine political revolution like we saw in 1932 with Franklin Roosevelt, it really began in 33, you know, the first year of his presidency, the second year. I think that it takes political will. It requires us to get involved, and that's the bottom line. And Kim, you're so spot on about how bad things are. I appreciate the call. I'm sorry we're out of time here at the bottom of the hour, and I got to go hop on a plane to San Francisco for our gig tomorrow night. So I'm going to be turning the microphone over to Carl Wolfson. I'll be talking to Larry Scott, and then up to Carl. I'm not sure. Maybe you're going to be picking up some calls on the other end. So stick around on the line, 866-303-2270, and I'll be back tomorrow.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartmann Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Welcome back. I'm Carl Wolfson in for Tom Hartmann. Tom is on his way to PDX right now, flying down to San Francisco. You can hear Tom the next 2 days on San Francisco's Green 960. In fact, tomorrow night, Tom will be appearing at a Night of Unity. That's at the Hotel Sofitel in Redwood City, California. Night of Unity for the California Democratic Party, and have Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton delegates there. Should be a good night. You can find all the information for that at green960.com. Well, it's a real pleasure to welcome Larry Scott. He's founder and editor of VAWatchdog.org. Larry, good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you again, Carl.
It's my pleasure. And, Larry, let me start with this, and I'm going to throw a two-parter at you here. Actually, there's an AP story this morning. I'm sure you've seen it. It says the number of troops with new cases of post-traumatic stress disorder jumped by roughly 50%. In 2007, amid the military buildup in Iraq and increased violence there and in Afghanistan, records show roughly 40,000 troops have been diagnosed with the illness, also known as PTSD, since 2003. And related to that, this is not in the AP story, but VA Secretary James Peake says the VA may be over-diagnosing PTSD, and vets might just need a little counseling. Why don't you tee off on those two for me?
Boy, I can tee off on James Peake, the VA secretary, really.
Let's have it,
Carl. Well, let's go back to the Army figures, and that is Eric Shoemaker, who is three-star general, lieutenant general, who is the Surgeon General of the Army, released these figures yesterday. 40,000 new cases of PTSD, or 40,000 cases of PTSD have now been diagnosed from people in the military. Those figures, basically, that means in 2007, those numbers have doubled from the year before. Those are striking numbers, and even more striking that Shoemaker now is coming out and handing these numbers to the media. They've never done that before. But the most important thing about what Shoemaker had to say is Shoemaker said, as a nation, our mental health capability is not adequate to the need, and the Army suffers from the same problem. So we understand there's a problem. You've got the top officials in the military saying not only cannot the civilian sector handle this, but the military sector can't handle this. So now we come across to the VA side, where we have VA Secretary James Peake, and we're starting to connect a lot of dots here that we didn't have before. Secretary Peake was chumming around Alaska over the Memorial Day weekend with his good buddy, Senator Ted Stevens, and they were visiting the troops, and Peake said that he feels that the VA is over-diagnosing PTSD, and as you mentioned earlier, that these vets might just need a little counseling and that we really shouldn't label them with PTSD for their entire lives. The hint here is if we counsel them first, then we don't give them a diagnosis, then there's no compensation for PTSD.
So it comes down to money.
It comes down to money. Now, let's connect further dots. About a week and a half ago, a VA psychologist by the name of Norma J. Perez, who heads up the PTSD team in Temple, Texas, at the VA facility there, sent out an email to her staff, which are psychologists, psychiatrists, and social workers, saying that since we have more troops seeking compensation or more veterans seeking compensation for PTSD, I would like you to refrain from giving a diagnosis of PTSD. Call it an adjustment disorder. Mm. Basically, what Ms. Perez said is, this is costing a lot of money. Let's not do this anymore. Let's not diagnose PTSD. Now, this has caused a firestorm all over the country and on Capitol Hill. You've got, on the left and the right, senators, congressmen calling for an investigation. And Barack Obama put it best. He's a member of the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs, and Obama says, well, let's find out what's going on here. Is this an incident, or is it a trend? Now, as we connect the dots, we look at what Norma Perez told her staff. We look at what VA Secretary James Peake said. No, we're over-diagnosing, and we shouldn't label these people. Therefore, we shouldn't compensate them. And some more dots get connected when we connect in Dr. Sally Satel, who is a paid, I'll just call her a hack, for the American Enterprise Institute. Satel is a psychiatrist. She has no great love of veterans, and she was on Capitol Hill last week testifying before the Senate on legislation sponsored by, of all people, Larry Craig, called Treatment First. Basically, for people with mental health issues, veterans, let's not give them compensation straight away. Let's treat them for a year or so and then see if they have PTSD. And then if they do, they might get some compensation.
So they're all of a sudden they're guinea pigs, not the heroes they are.
That's right. And what it is we get this full circle now. All the dots are connected. We've got the American Enterprise Institute pushing. We've got senators pushing for treatment first, not a diagnosis and not compensation. You've got Secretary James Peake saying that this is not the way to go. You have VA psychologists, supervisors handing out memos saying, don't diagnose PTSD because these people are here seeking compensation and we don't want to do that. And then what we're really looking at here is finally we're getting a large picture of the VA does not want to spend the money for compensation for troops with post-traumatic stress disorder. They would rather give them a treatment first, declare them cured, which many in the VA says there is a cure for PTSD, then deny them compensation, even though many of these people are unable to work, Carl, to maintain proper relationships, to get on with a proper life.
Well, we're speaking with Larry Scott. He's founder and editor of VAWatchdog.org. And a couple things, Larry. First of all, you mentioned that these figures, and we're talking about the new figures of post-traumatic stress disorder among U.S. troops coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. You said they were striking numbers. Compare this rate to, let's say, Vietnam or other wars in our history.
What's happening here is that we're seeing a higher percentage of troops coming out of Iraq and Afghanistan who are being diagnosed with PTSD. But part of that is because we know what it is and we have a name for it.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, PTSD was not codified by the American Psychiatric Association until 1980. What we found now is we go back and look from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, the first Gulf War, but especially Vietnam, we're finding many of these troops do have the symptoms of PTSD and have had a problem with PTSD for many, many years. They did not have an actual diagnosis. They did not have a name to put on it. They could call it shell shock. They called it any number of things. But we're finding now these troops are coming forward in greater and greater numbers. In the last 4 years, the number of World War II veterans who have been awarded PTSD by the PTSD compensation by the VA has more than doubled. These are World War II troops.
In addition, Larry, in this situation, in Iraq especially, we have troops serving second, third, fourth tours of duty.
And this had never happened before. You're lucky to find guys coming out of Vietnam who served two tours, and usually the ones who served two tours went back on their own for the second tour. They weren't stop-lost. They weren't called back. They weren't pulled out of the inactive ready reserve or the guard or the reserve. and said, okay, you've got to serve 2, 3, 4 tours. It's an unusual situation in Iraq and Afghanistan. We're trying to fight big wars with very, very few people, and it is obviously taking its toll, Carl.
Larry, just to get a little bit farther into PTSD, people with this, troops who have this, can actually relive those traumatic events that initially induced this condition. Is that right?
Yes, I am not a psychiatrist, and I'm not a mental health professional, but they do. And what it is, it's a memory situation. The memories of the battles come back. Many of them will tell you they can actually see, actually taste, actually smell what happened to them on the battlefield, that the images are so strong, and they find that this really causes problems in their life, from very simple things, like even getting up and getting dressed in the morning. Depression can set in. They don't want to function on any level. We find a great number of these troops self-medicating because they're afraid to go out and seek help from the VA or from the military. They will self-medicate with over-the-counter drugs or street drugs or alcohol, of course, the easiest of all of the self-medications to get a hold of. This causes severe problems. These problems trickle down not only into their relationships, but then trickle down to the community. And here's where the VA and the military has to be on top of treating these people. Because if they don't, then you and I are going to end up doing it as our troops and our veterans seek help in the community and in the private healthcare sector. It's the government's responsibility. And the government isn't doing a good job. And I was in a healthcare symposium just a few weeks ago at Washington State University. And one of the most interesting things that was mentioned was people from the private healthcare sector who talked about the great number of veterans and active duty military people that are coming into their private healthcare providers, into clinics, private doctors, clinicians, hospitals, seeking mental health treatment, paying for it out of their own pocket because they do not want the military or the VA to have that in their records.
Larry Scott is our guest. He's founder and editor of VAWatchdog.org. Larry, just about a minute left. I haven't talked to you since the new GI Bill for the 21st century passed the Senate, 7522. It's part of the Iraq War funding bill. In the House now, what are the chances in the House? The House has a few more strings attached. Do you think we're going to get this out of the House and Senate, and is it going to be veto-proof? Because I know the president has threatened to veto it.
Depends who you talk to on that. excuse me. It is out of the House, okay? That particular portion of it is out of the House, and it's on the way to the president's desk. The president has threatened to veto it. What's happened there is we don't know if he's going to. If the president vetoes, it should have been on his desk late last week. We think that was delayed, Carl, because of the Memorial Day holiday, that he didn't want to act on it then. So what we're seeing is it could be veto-proof. We're just going to have to wait on that and see.
Larry, it's great having you on. Again, Larry Scott, founder and editor of VAWatchdog.org. Larry, talk to you down the line. Great work.
Okay, thank you, Carl.
My pleasure, Larry Scott. Your calls when we come back, 866-303-2270, 866-303-2270. A lot to talk about today, the Scott McClellan book. Plenty more. I'm Carl Wolfson, sitting in for Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
Man, Tom Hartman has better music than we do on the KPOJ morning show in Portland. I like it. Carl Wolfson with you on the Tom Hartman program. And Tom's on his way to San Francisco. You can hear him the next 2 days on San Francisco's Green 960. In fact, tomorrow night in Redwood City in California, Tom will be featured at a Night of Unity for the Democratic Party. You can get all those details at green960.com. And speaking of unity for the Democratic Party, that big DNC rules meeting is going to be on Saturday, and depending on how they reallocate those delegates from Florida and Michigan, Barack Obama might be very close to what he needs for the nomination, might be a little under, might be a little over. But Mark Embinder at TheAtlantic.com writes today that, and I'll quote it, to prepare for the eventuality, the Obama campaign has, for the first time, really begun to bank delegates. Sources close to the campaign estimate that as many as 36 superdelegates have privately pledged to announce their support for Obama on June 4th or 5th. The campaign is determined that Obama not end the first week in June without securing the support of delegates numbering 2026 or 2210, as the case may be. They may have to move those goalposts if they include Florida and Michigan, and they're going to have to. But either way, according to TheAtlantic.com, Barack Obama will have enough in the bank to declare victory in the nomination on June 4th or 5th. And, hey, you know, there was a primary yesterday. A lot of people don't know it. The Republicans voted in Idaho yesterday. And here's some bad news for John McCain. Yesterday in Idaho, John McCain got just 70% of the Republican vote. He got about 87,000 votes. Ron Paul got nearly 30,000 votes in that primary in Idaho yesterday. Uncommitted, about 8,000 votes. That means 30% did not vote for John McCain in that Idaho primary. And this has been a pattern in North Carolina, Indiana, Pennsylvania, other states, around 70% not voting for John McCain. We have Bob Barr, now the official candidate of the Libertarian Party. Will Ron Paul throw his support to Bob Barr? Can they pick off 1-2% in a number of states to give John McCain some headaches this November? And some other bad news for John McCain, if you want to link him to George Bush, and of course that's bad news. According, this is at Think Progress, according to a Congressional Quarterly analysis of Senate votes on issues where President Bush has expressed an explicit stated opinion, John McCain voted with President Bush, you ready for this, 100% of the time in 2008. In 2007, it was 95% of the time. You want to tie John McCain to George Bush? There's another reason for you to do it. And one little poll before we take some calls that jumped out at me. This is kind of an underreported story. Everybody thinks between 4 and 8 pickups in the Senate for the Dems this fall. I think it may be as high as 9 or 10. We certainly got an incredible shot in New Hampshire with Gene Shaheen. In Virginia, Mark Warner. Colorado, Mark Udall. We have a great shot in Minnesota, New Mexico, here in the state of Oregon. We're going to knock off Gordon Smith. But there are other races that you wouldn't think would be close. In Rick Noriega, the Democrat in Texas, is very close to incumbent John Cornyn in the polls down there. And this poll this morning just leaped out at me. The Rasmussen poll yesterday in the state of Kentucky. Bruce Lunsford, the Democratic candidate for Senate, is leading Mitch McConnell, longtime Republican incumbent, 49-44. That's a 5-point spread for the Democrat in Kentucky. Look, you start putting Kentucky on the board, and wow, you're talking a big, big year for the Dems. Of course, it's a long way out. We don't want to run like we're ahead. We want to run like we're behind. But these numbers from states like Michigan and Kentucky give us great hope. Kevin in Fort Lauderdale, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, Kevin.
Listen, you know, in listening to your last guest and those, the fact that, you know, those types of realities, it surprised me that it doesn't point up the fact that those people that most loudly trumpet patriotism, you know, and call those of us that question the direction the country is heading, particularly in terms of the war, you know, as being somehow the hate America first crowd. When you really look at the reality of it, it's a shame, I believe, that more people are not outraged at the abuse of patriotism.
Absolutely. Look who, Kevin, you're absolutely right. Look who is acting in the best interests of the troops, the best interests of the veterans in this country. You know, the New York Times editorialized on Monday, I believe, about the new GI Bill for the 21st century and how George Bush says he'll veto it. And what was the story on Fox News? It was how that liberal New York Times is attacking George Bush for not supporting the troops. Well, George Bush doesn't support the troops. He didn't support them by not doing what he needed to do before he invaded Iraq and Afghanistan. He's not doing it now, taking care with our veterans. And that's the truth, and you're right. What is patriotism? And I'm sick of having the Republicans and the conservatives define patriotism for us.
Absolutely. You know, people are confusing nationalism, which is a political strategy, a propaganda strategy, with patriotism. and insincere and or self-ambitious politicians throughout history in many countries have used nationalism at, you know, to generate people's sincere patriotism and manipulate them.
Hey, Kevin, Tom's not here, but I'll tell you what he would say. You're spot on, Kevin. Thanks for the call. Let's get a quick one from Lily in Los Angeles, my old stomping grounds. Lily, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hi. I just wanted to ask about Hillary. If she's claiming that if she can get her Michigan and Florida and this Saturday, is it possible that she, with her popular vote, you know, if she gets Florida and Michigan, can she get the superdelegates to go for her? Is it truly possible?
Lily, I'll take your call off the air. Thanks for the question. I don't think it's possible. Barack Obama's campaign person, David Axelrod, senior campaign advisor, has said we'll be more than willing to go more than halfway with Florida and Michigan. That's because the Obama campaign knows they're going to get some delegates out of Michigan and Florida. They don't need that many. They're really in the driver's seat. The math is not with Senator Clinton at all. And she has to end this thing soon, by June 15th. I think all the signs are that there's going to be unity in the Democratic Party, that she wants to be carrying the flag for Florida and Michigan. She'll do that this Saturday at the rules meeting. But Barack Obama certainly will have enough, I think, to claim victory on June 4th and June 5th. Hillary Clinton is no fool. She knows that the interests of the Democratic Party have to rule here, or her career will not be worth much. Hey, Tom Hartman's down in San Francisco. You can hear him on San Francisco's Green 960 the next 2 days. My pleasure sitting in for Tom. And remember, go to green960.com for all the info on Tom's event, A Night of Unity, down in Redwood City in the San Francisco Bay Area. Carl Wolfson with you on the Tom Hartman program. Remember, it's your country. Get out there and take it back.